Welcome to Two-Way Street. If you wanted to make a list of the most notorious traitors in history, who would you put at the top? Probably Judas Iscariot. He betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. But Benedict Arnold would probably be right up there, too. History has taught us that Arnold was the guy who sold out his fellow Americans by abandoning his duty as a general in the Continental Army and working with the British to defeat the colonists. But Nathaniel Philbrick gives us a different perspective on Arnold in his book Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Philbrick tells us that Arnold's motivations for deserting were part of a larger, mostly untold story about the dark side of the revolution. He describes the political infighting, jockeying for power, and McCarthy-like witch hunts to identify disloyal Americans that began turning neighbor against neighbor, even as the fight against the British unfolded. Philbrick tells his story through the contrasting trajectories of two careers forged by the revolution. George Washington, who of course became one of America's greatest heroes, and Arnold, whose name became synonymous with treachery and betrayal. Philbrick is one of our best-known authors of nonfiction. He won the 2000 National Book Award for In the Heart of the Sea, the true story of the doomed whaling voyage that became the inspiration for Moby Dick. And his book Mayflower was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Nonfiction in 2007. Valiant Ambition has just been published in paperback, so it was a good time to sit down and talk with Philbrick about the book. Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you so much for being here for Two-Way Street. Your book is Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution, your newest book. I want to start, if I may, with something that I found in the acknowledgments that I thought was really interesting. You say at the very beginning of the acknowledgments that one of your biggest debts is to your mother, who had a lifelong fascination with Benedict Arnold. I don't think many people's mothers would have a fascination with Benedict Arnold.
Well, my mother was a unique individual. She trod her own path through life, and she was one of these people who loved to tell people exactly what she thought, particularly if she knew they wouldn't agree with her. You know, she just was different that kind of way. And one of her personal heroes was Benedict Arnold, which when I was a kid growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I'd say, "Mom, what are you talking about? If someone calls me a Benedict Arnold, it's the worst thing you can be told, you know, the ultimate traitor." And my mom would always insist, "No, he got a raw deal. He was our best general. Things happened. That's, you know, what the story everyone assumes is true is not necessarily the whole story."
You give us a really fresh look at the American Revolution on the way to telling us the story of both George Washington and Benedict Arnold. And one of the things you say at the very beginning of the book is that we have always been taught that the American Revolution, I'm using my words, not yours, but essentially you tell us that they were heroic figures who had a noble cause, and it was that cause which united them, brought them together to defeat the British in a war that they never should have been able to win. And you say this: "The real revolution was so troubling and strange that once the struggle was over, a generation did its best to remove all traces of the truth." And you talk to us about Charles Thompson. Who was Charles Thompson?
Well, he was one historian has described him as the prime minister of the Continental Congress. There were a series of presidents of the Continental Congress. John Hancock is the most famous for signing the Declaration of Independence. But there were a series of them, and they would move in and out. And there was one secretary, this man. And Charles Thompson. And so he was there. He bore witness to the very beginnings of the revolution, taking it through to the very end. And late in life, by this time, the 19th century has kicked in, and people are heroicizing the memory of the revolution. And he writes a manuscript about the controversies, quarrels, and arguments related to the founding of the country. And And it goes to thousands of pages. And as the myth of the genesis of America is growing, he begins to realize, wait, I can't publish this because what I describe are ordinary men not knowing where they're going, personal ambition, prejudice operating into it, violent arguments that were kept primarily secret, but which he knew about, he was describing. And he realized, if I publish this, it will be contrary to what everyone's heard. And finally he decided, well, maybe it's better I don't.
Yeah, you have a quote from him. He said, "Let the world admire the supposed wisdom and valor of our great men. Perhaps they may adopt the qualities that have been ascribed to them, and thus good may be done. I shall not undeceive future generations."
Yeah. And, for me, this is, in all the books of history I've written, this is kind of the revelation of all of them. We do have this tendency to think that in the past, these people saw things clearer than we do, that they knew where they were going, that they had nobler motivations. But the truth of the matter is the time in which we're living, which is chaotic, murky, scary, is very similar. It's different times, obviously. But those were the kinds of feelings people had back then. No one knew where it was going. And people who would later on prefer people to judge them acting out of the best interest of the country were really motivated by self-interest to a large degree. And so for me, Charles Thompson's take on this was revelatory in that, here is someone who was there. He saw it. There was no one else in a better position to comment on what was really going on in the halls of Congress during, those first seminal years. And this is what he says. And so for me, that became a real kind of a modus operandi for this book, trying to get beneath the surface, trying to unlock the personal struggles people were undergoing. And I think this makes someone like Washington all the more heroic. He's flawed in so many ways, but ultimately he is able to rise above all these challenges, both within his own personality and presented by those around him, and see it through.
You tell us, for instance, about Sergeant Thomas Hickey, who was accused of plotting against Washington. This was in 1776.
Hickey was one of his soldiers, and this is before the Declaration of Independence. And mm-hmm. So technically, America is part of the British Empire at this point. And he reaches the point where he decides that, in the best interest of his country, which is Great Britain, he must betray George Washington and basically turn over the keys to the American army to the British who are about to arrive in New York Harbor. And so, how do you accuse Hickey of treason when, all the treason laws that exist on the books, are written about someone doing things contrary to the goodwill of the king. And he is the only one in this instance who is looking out for the king.
So Washington tries him by military tribunal.
Right. And he gets hanged with thousands of people watching. And, it's before the Declaration of Independence. You could argue that Washington, this is his statement of independence. And, and it's a side of him. We think of Washington as the figure on the $1 bill, that older staid pragmatist that looks at us, with the eyes of a statue. And in truth, during the Revolution in 1776, he was in his early 40s. He's red-haired. He's by temperament quite aggressive. He wants more than anything to defeat the British in battle, even though he doesn't really have an army up to that task. And yet, he's willing to take risks, and, he's in his own way a kind of firebrand. And that's, I think, contrary to the image most of us have of George Washington.
Well, and of course, his leadership in the battle for New York, in which he eventually loses New York to the British, raises immediate questions among many of his critics as to whether he has the intelligence, the understanding of warfare to be able to lead the Patriots against the British. What's fascinating to me is the way in which weather in a number of battles played into the Americans' favor. So, for instance, when the Patriots are stuck on Long Island and have to escape, they are saved to some extent by a dense fog which descends and masks their escape from Long Island. Of course it's merely by chance, but you do have to think about whether someone was watching out for them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this happens time and time again. And interestingly enough, at the end, basically at the end of the Revolution, after Yorktown, Washington, in a letter to another American general, would say, you know, he looks back and he just, you know, he can't believe they won this thing. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he says, if you're not sure about God, all you have to look at is how we won this revolution. I mean, and that's what for me is, it's so dramatic, this material. You see, and it's not all people making the right decisions that win the day. It's happenstance. It's a change in the weather. It's a mistake on the opponent's part. And it creates this roller coaster ride that, for me, makes Washington's ability to just hang in there year after year through these ups and downs all the more impressive, because it had to take a huge emotional toll, and yet he hung in there. Right. And, you know, and on to Washington's credit, he was placed in a basically an impossible situation.
Sure.
You know, but the fact of the matter is he didn't have experience leading a large army in battle. No one really had that experience when it came to the American generals. Even those who were formerly British generals had never really been in that position. And from the beginning, you know, he distinguished himself by selecting major generals and brigadier generals who were quite young. Someone like Nathaniel Greene was in his 30s, had no real military experience prior to this. That Henry Knox, the head of the artillery, he had been a bookseller when the Revolution broke out. But Washington recognized that these young men were of immense talent, and he would be proven out over the course of the Revolution. But in 1776, when it all went wrong at the Battle of Brooklyn, and the American forces were forced to retreat into New York, and then retreat from New York and ultimately across the whole breadth of New Jersey to the Delaware River. At that point, people begin to second guess Washington and say, look, he's hired these basically young kids for a staff. He's got no one to rely on. He's overmatched. And so almost immediately, people are beginning to undercut him. Even his adjutant general, Joseph Reed, begins to exchange letters with the second in command in the American Army, Charles Lee, saying, you know, when this all goes south by winter, maybe you should be the one to lead a new army. And so this is all going on. And I think a lot of many of us are not aware of how embattled Washington was.
Let's talk about Benedict Arnold. You introduced Benedict Arnold to us when he is on the deck of a schooner, I think, at Lake Champlain. Why was he there, and why was Lake Champlain so important at that point in the war?
Yeah, well, you know, this was in the day before highways. You know, all the roads in America were miserable, and when you came to the northern edges of America along the Canadian border, there basically weren't roads. And so the only way to transport a large army was by water. And this meant that a corridor of water that extends north and south, beginning in the south at New York on the Hudson River, you follow that straight north past Albany, where you take a little jog right to Lake George and then to Lake Champlain, which is a lake. It's called a lake, but it's really almost river-like in its configuration, and it extends more than 100 miles into Canada. And this corridor of water was the only way for an invading force to come into that part of the country. And what both sides realized is whoever controlled that corridor of water would be in a position to cut off New England from the rest of the colonies. And once you accomplish that, that would be the end of the war from the colony's standpoint. And so while Howe takes Washington, beats Washington and takes New York. There is another army coming down from the north, down Lake Champlain, and with a relatively speaking, a pretty large armada of schooners, you know, man of war, thousands of soldiers, and there's this, the only American general between them, and taking Fort Ticonderoga, which was at the southern tip of Lake Champlain, and taking Albany on the Hudson and getting that corridor is Benedict Arnold. And he had professionally had been a seagoing merchantman. So he had a lot of sailing experience. Now, he was very well acquainted with the northern waters of America. And that summer, he had been building a fleet of 15 vessels, you know, literally hacking these ships out of the wilderness. And he had a bunch of landlubbers for crew members. And it was his job to try to delay this British armada from sailing down Lake Champlain and taking Fort Ticonderoga. I mean, it was virtually an impossible task, but as events would prove, he was up to the challenge.
You describe him as being short, solidly built, handsome, charismatic, black hair, gray eyes, and you say he was blessed with almost superhuman energy and endurance. And maybe it was partly because of his energy and endurance that he had a sense of bravado and led his troops throughout his career to tremendous risks. And yet, Ticonderoga, defending that against the British, sort of showed both sides of him. He took too many risks. He put his men in danger, but he prevailed. He held Ticonderoga.
Yeah, I mean, Arnold was, I think, bar none, our best battlefield commander in the first years of the war. He was, by temperament, very aggressive, as you mentioned. He was charismatic. In the midst of battle, there was no one better than inspiring his men. He had a real ability to recognize the vulnerabilities of his opponent very quickly. And he reveled in sort of that swashbuckling aura he had begun to develop very early on in the Revolution, where, you know, and so he had already led a ragtag band through the wilderness of Maine to the fortress at Quebec that won him the title of the American Hannibal. You know, this was the kind of guy. And if you served under him and it all went well, it was, you know, it was amazing, but it was also pretty darn terrifying, I think, if you were one of his officers under him. And so with Benedict Arnold, you never knew if he was taking the great risk because it was, it was the best thing in terms of the battle, or it was going to garnish his reputation. And but, you know, the fact of the matter is, at what's known as the Battle of Valcour Island, fought on Lake Champlain, he was able to postpone the British advance. They ultimately would decide to postpone the attempt on Fort Ticonderoga to the following year. I mean, it's just amazing. But he lost his fleet in the process. He was ordered to do just a defensive attempt that was stopping the British. He went right into it, but he accomplished it. It was against impossible odds. And what he also did in delaying the British taking of Fort Ticonderoga by a year was he set up what would be the great victory almost a year later at Saratoga, of which he would be a great part. And so the book begins with Washington at his lowest, losing New York and being forced across the Delaware, and Arnold at his highest, in this incredible performance on Lake Champlain.
One of the other things about Benedict Arnold is that he was a man of great ambition and a desire for wealth. He felt as if he had never been able to achieve the station in life that he deserved. And that becomes an issue really from very early on for him. After the victory at Valcour, he expects that the Continental Congress is going to look upon him favorably and reward him for his victory. But that isn't what happens.
No, it isn't what happens. You know, and the tragedy of Benedict Arnold is, if he had just not been so insistent that, hey, you pay me for the money I've lost, you give me the promotion I deserve, if he had just backed off, enough of his peers would have come to his defense and it would have happened. You know, I think we all know people who are just too much of themselves. They may be right in insisting that they're getting a raw deal, but in their inability to be tactful when it comes to the powers that be, they make their own situation worse by insisting that they be treated differently. And Arnold was one of these people. The passions he felt that contributed to his success on the battlefield, he could not modulate them when presented with ordinary political life of a general. And so he would inevitably anger other officers, as well as particularly the politicians that were members of the Continental Congress, who really were the ones that ruled his destiny. And so you see him rightfully frustrated, treated shabbily, and yet by his own anger and frustration, making it only worse for himself.
Yeah, at one point, I think we're at it's 1777, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, when the Congress has an opportunity to promote several generals from brigadier general, am I right, to major general, and Arnold expects he's going to be one of them, and he's not. And he's stunned to learn that he's not being rewarded for the way in which he's comported himself in battle.
And, another person who was stunned was Washington.
Yeah.
This was a new policy that Congress, in their wisdom, had enacted, whereby Washington could not pick the major generals, the officers upon whom he depended the most. It would be a political appointment determined by the Continental Congress, and they decided that there would be a quota system. Each state would get two major generals, and since Connecticut, which was Arnold's home state, already had two major generals, this meant that Arnold, who was the highest-ranking brigadier with the best record, would be overlooked, and more than five brigadier generals would be elevated past him. And, this was pretty outrageous. Washington immediately writes to Arnold and says, look, I'm not sure what's going on here, because he hadn't been informed of this new policy, but let me look into this. To his credit, Arnold hangs in there, but he's disgruntled, and this really begins his downward spiral. But to his credit, there were some officers, John Stark, for example, from New Hampshire, when treated in a similar fashion, said, the heck with it, I quit. And he then, then fought on in a New Hampshire, for his local forces.
A militia.
Yeah. And then the Continental Army. And so Arnold hung in there. And yet, given his personality, it really rankled, and it created that, the viper had turned within his breast, and it began a gradual descent into, a state of true anger and frustration that would ultimately culminate years later with his decision to betray his country.
We're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, more with Nathaniel Philbrick. If you're just joining us, my guest on this edition of Two Way Street is New York Times bestselling author Nathaniel Philbrick. He won the National Book Award in 2000 for In the Heart of the Sea, and he was named a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for his book Mayflower. We're talking with him about his book Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution, which has just been published in paperback. In it, Philbrick upsets our conventional view of how the American Revolution unfolded, and he paints a portrait of Benedict Arnold that helps us understand how much more complex Arnold was than the simple traitor history has made him out to be. You pointed out that it was politicians often found him intolerable, but one who didn't was John Adams. You quote him, John Adams, in a letter that he wrote to Abigail, at the moment, basically when the promotions have been handed out and Arnold is coming and appealing and saying, I deserve this, and I think this is an important quote because it sets up a lot of what happens later in your book. Adams says, I am wearied to death with the wrangles between military officers high and low. They quarrel like cats and dogs. But he says that he does think that Arnold was extraordinarily brave and must remain a casualty of Congress's insistence that Washington's generals be selected by the country's civil government, which you've already talked about. So here you are setting up, to some extent, this theme that goes through the book about just that. We kind of think of again, our sort of storybook version of the Revolution is that the Continental Congress was the law of the land. What they decided was accepted and followed by the people of America, and yet they were bogged down in constant battles, weren't they?
Absolutely. You know, a dysfunctional Congress is nothing new. In fact, it was a part of our very identity from the beginning. And, you know, a revolution is a very dangerous thing when it comes to trying to create a republic, because if you look at the history of revolutions prior to this, when a republic was the intended result, they had all ended up with the civil government being so incapable of governing in the wake of this revolution that the military leader, whether it was Caesar or Oliver Cromwell in the English Revolution, they simply take over. And so that was the great threat that the Continental Congress was fearful of, quite properly. But the fact is the states were not willing to give the Continental Congress the power it needed to effectively govern. They did not have the ability to tax the American people directly, which meant that they were incapable of raising the money required to fund Washington's army. They were always broke. They were always under-provisioned, without ammunition. And this was because the Continental Congress really had no control. And so instead of a United States, it was really 13 independent polities that were quarreling and refusing to come up with their share. And so, and on the other side of it, they were fearful that Washington, who by this quickly becomes the preeminent person in America, is reaching a status that's monarchical. John Adams, who you just quoted, was particularly concerned about this, that, you know, if Washington had been a different person, if he had been a Napoleon, for example, out of frustration, and he would have just said, I need to be a dictator here if we're going to get through this. And he didn't. And once again, it feeds to his incredible reserves of patience and endurance, his ability to realize that, yes, Continental Congress is ineffective. It's making my life very difficult. But if we are going to have the country we want to have at the end of all this, the civil government must remain in control. And so, it was Washington was the only, I think, the only person you could find who would be willing to operate with those kinds of shackles.
Yeah. So there were fights. You point out at one point there comes a time when some of the civilian population was more suspicious of the Continental Army than they were of their own militias, because they weren't certain. They seemed to be perhaps a band of mercenaries like the Hessian troops that fought for the British. So there's that kind of tension going on between civilian populations and army and militia. And then there are, of course, fights that you describe among the ranks of the leaders of the army. So one of the big ones is between Horatio Gates and Philip Schuyler for control of the Northern Army. And Benedict Arnold, that's important for us to talk about briefly even, because Benedict Arnold gets caught up in that in a very big way, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, you're right, that there were all these internal bickerings within Washington's officer corps. And what made it so all the more frustrating for Washington is he didn't really control it, because they could appeal directly to Congress. And so Horatio Gates was angling to lead the Northern Army. Philip Schuyler was initially that leader. And they just go at it. And it depends who's, and it becomes this huge political battle. Ultimately, Horatio Gates proves victorious and will lead the Northern Army at the Battle of Saratoga. But Arnold, who is a friend to both of them in 1776, gets caught up in it. And it's one of those, what is he supposed to do? You know, is he supposed to disavow one or both? And what makes it all the harder from Gates's point of view is that Arnold has this reputation as being an aggressive winner, where Gates's reputation is more of a cunning political general. And with really no experience leading an army in battle. And so when it comes to the Battle of Saratoga, Horatio Gates is the commander in chief. Arnold is under him. Gates is already suspicious of him. And it becomes this nightmare for Arnold, where with Gates trying to contain him in a way that will mean that Gates gets the majority of the glory.
Yeah, you, Arnold, ever the not politically wise leader, once he realizes that Gates is going to be leading the army, the Northern Army, Arnold appoints two aides who are aligned with Schuyler, which strikes me as just a sort of a defiant move that is going to further erode his position with Horatio Gates.
Absolutely, and it's just so typical of Arnold. And I have to say, time and time again, writing this book, I would go, Arnold, what are you doing? You're on the cusp of a great victory. You know, you could do this. Why do this small-minded, petty thing that will have these huge repercussions? But this is Arnold. This is what he continually would do to himself. And so he creates this absolutely poisonous internal dynamic within the American Army at Saratoga. And, you know, they would try to treat each other with some civility, but ultimately would blow up into a huge argument between Arnold and Horatio Gates.
Okay, so it's October 1777, and I think your description of the battle and Arnold's behavior in that battle is just great. And Arnold is not in the battle. He's back at camp with Horatio Gates. And you tell us that Colonel Morgan Lewis, comes back from the battle to report in. What happens?
He comes back to report on the battle. And because what's happening is Gates won't let Arnold on the battlefield.
Right.
Because he's fearful that Arnold will lead them to glory. And he, you know, he insists that he wants to stay back at headquarters. And so they can't even see what's going on. They can only hear. And so they're getting these messages. And, you know, Lewis comes back and Arnold says, let's go for it. And it becomes this, you know, huge battle between them, and as a consequence, you know, the Battle of Freeman's Farm, which was the first of two battles that we now call the Battle of Saratoga, would end up basically being a draw, but a very good one from American standpoint, because the British were dealt a very severe blow, and it would be Arnold's soldiers that had done it. And subsequent to all this, Gates's official report of the Battle of Freeman's Farm would not make, of course, no mention of Arnold.
Well, when he hears the battle is a draw, as he's standing with Horatio Gates, when Lewis reports back, he jumps on his horse and rides off to battle. Gates is horrified that Arnold has decided to do this on his own, and he sends Morgan Lewis to go pull him back. And you say to us that this was a humiliating moment for Arnold to be called back, or the attempt to call him back, by Morgan Lewis, who had at one point been his underling. And he doesn't come back. As you point out, he rides into battle, but he's disorganized. You say he's kind of wild, and that his behavior was more pathetic than heroic.
Gates and Arnold knew each other pretty well.
Okay.
And Gates knew what buttons to push when it came to Arnold.
Uh-huh.
And so he just drove him, basically, I think you could argue it was a version of insanity. You know, there would be nothing more frustrating for a person of Arnold's temperament not to be allowed to lead his men into battle. And this is what Gates insisted on doing. And so once Arnold does go into battle at the Battle of Bemis Heights, they describe him more like a wild man than a general. You know, he's someone who has, you know, been, I think you could argue, really psychically scarred by what Gates has inflicted upon him. And yet, you know, ultimately, this would be a huge American victory. Arnold would lead an assault on one of the critical redoubts of the British, get terribly injured when a German soldier would fire his musket and hit Arnold in his left leg, shatter the bones in it, and kill the horse. The horse would collapse on top of him. And one of his subordinates would come up and said, "Are you badly hurt?" And his response would be, "I wish the musket ball had gone through my heart."
Yeah.
You know, I think that says it all. You know, it was just so upsetting for him that he knew at this point Gates would get the credit for a victory that he had been largely responsible for. And it's, you know, and this was a physical manifestation of the kind of treatment he felt he had been receiving for more than a year.
You talk about the one thing that Arnold does. It's Arnold who looks at the battlefield and has this ability to see what's happening. And he notices, isn't it at the Bemis Heights battle where he realizes that there's one British officer who's directing the whole battle on the right flank, and so he sends word that he needs that officer killed by a sniper.
Right, and you know, and what's, you know, and according to several accounts, at this point, Arnold is a raving lunatic as he, you know, rides around the battlefield. But if that's the case, how did he have the presence of mind? And we have, you know, a pretty reliable witness to this to say, wait a minute. You know, that officer over there, if we can get, you know, he's the key person. If we can get him, this will go a long way in bringing back a British reversal. And so there was a group of Virginia riflemen up in the trees, you know, the snipers. It's not a new concept. It's been around for a while. And so one of these guys from Virginia, it takes three shots, but ultimately he fells that officer. And sure enough, the British line collapses and they retreat into their redoubts. And, you know, and it's because Arnold keenly was aware of what was going on in the battle.
Okay.
You know, so yeah, I mean, he was a man of extraordinary talents.
It's time for another break. We'll be back to continue our conversation with Nathaniel Philbrick in just a minute. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Let's get back to our conversation with Nathaniel Philbrick. His book, Valiant Ambition, has just been published in paperback. It upends many of our conventional views of the American Revolution, including the narrow way in which history has painted Benedict Arnold as little more than a traitor to his country. Joseph Reed becomes a major character in your telling of this story at a certain point. And it struck me that if you were going to look at someone, he was not a traitor ever in the way that Arnold did become a traitor to the Patriots, but he fomented enormous dissension, suspicion. How do you describe Joseph? First of all, who was he? And what was he all about?
Yeah, I mean, for my money, he is one of the more fascinating characters when it comes to the American Revolution. Joseph Reed was a young lawyer from Philadelphia who had been educated in Great Britain and a very bright person. You know, one of those guys is always the smartest person in the room and, you know, a kind of volatile personality, but Washington hit it off with him during the siege of Boston at the very beginning, and Reed typically decided he had to go home, so he left. And so we have the wonderful letters that Washington would write to Reed in the first year of the Revolution. But then Reed would come back as his adjutant general in 1776, at the Battle of Long Island during the loss of New York. And we have several accounts of how Reed, that had a talent for wading into a situation he probably had no reason to wade into, and just, you know, causing it to blow up when it came to other officers in the American forces. And he, at when Washington is at his absolute lowest during the retreat across New Jersey, he begins a correspondence with Charles Lee, who is then the second-ranking American general, basically behind Washington's back, saying, "You know, we're going to. This is going badly. Maybe you should be the one to bring lead the American forces in the incoming year." Washington opens one of Reed's letters basically by accident. Reed's realizes that the man he trusts more than anyone is basically having a conversation behind his back about his inadequacies. Reed is out of headquarters at this point. Reed seals the letter, sends it to Reed with a cover note saying, this came to headquarters thinking it was official business. I opened it, realizing it's not. My apologies. And so leaving Reed to twist in the icy emptiness of his withheld wrath. And Reed quickly left his staff, would ultimately become the most powerful man in Pennsylvania when he was the head of the state legislature.
He reminded me in some ways, the way you describe him when he does become, as he's consolidating his power in Pennsylvania, there's a sort of a Joseph McCarthy kind of feel to him. He, at one point, prosecutes 23 suspected traitors who he and others accused of working with the Brits. There was almost no evidence for most of those. And two Quakers eventually are hanged, even though the evidence that they have been conspiring with the British is somewhat lacking as well, right?
Absolutely. And they're hanged, even though thousands of Pennsylvanians, including many Continental officers, signed petitions saying, do not do this. This will serve absolutely no purpose. But this was Reed. He could be dogmatic and highly controversial. And ultimately, after the Battle of Saratoga, when Arnold comes back as you know, his leg, he can barely walk, Washington appoints him military governor of Philadelphia after the British have evacuated. And Reed and Arnold just go at it. And it's, you could argue that much of Arnold's decision to betray his country is ignited by the veritable witch hunt and it is very McCarthy-like. It's a good analogy, comparison that Reed launches against Arnold, and he was someone whether it was the interests of his state, he would pursue even if it was contrary to the good of the country. He was just one of those people who invited controversy, was a lightning rod.
Yes, but this is also why you tell us at the very beginning of your book that the real story of the American Revolution is so much more troubling than we realize. It's partly this sort of thing. It's the hunting for traitors. You tell us about Neutral Ground, which is up in Westchester County in New York, right, where you have loyalists and patriots essentially in gangs in lawless behavior up there, right?
It became a civil war. And by the midpoint of the revolution, it's not the British that we have to worry about. It's ourselves. Yeah. And it's former neighbors literally raping and pillaging each other, settling old scores. You know, no one's concerned at this point about, you know, getting the Brits out. The war is stalemated. It becomes a squalid internal struggle. That contributed to Arnold's decision to ultimately betray his country. He came to the decision, we have defaulted on the promise we made to each other with the Declaration of Independence. From his point of view, the best thing he could do for his countrymen was to bring back the British as bloodlessly as possible and restore the freedoms that they had all known prior to the Revolution. You know, so it's that didn't prevent him from insisting that the British pay for the privilege, which means that, you know, he was hardly doing this out of his the goodness of his heart. And yet this is the disturbing part about all this. This didn't necessarily bring out the best in people. It made it an incredibly difficult situation that no one could be proud of. And, you know, and it relates kind of to what Charles Thompson said at the beginning. The truth was disturbing, and this is how it came about.
People will read your book, and they will learn in detail all of the elements that pushed Benedict Arnold to decide to go over to the British. But I want to pick up on that, if I can, with a couple of things that you've said that I think are important. You say to us that, in fact, Benedict Arnold did a favor to the American people when he betrayed the country. He caused Americans to recognize something very important about themselves. Tell us what that is.
Right. Well, when he word got out that he had unsuccessfully attempted to surrender West Point to the British, This was like a lightning bolt hitting the American people. He was, our best general has done this to us. You know, it created such outrage that people that had basically turned their back on the cause became galvanized by this horrific act. He was burned in effigy up and down in towns up and down the Atlantic seaboard, and within a year would come the great victory at Yorktown. And I think the great irony of Arnold's life is that as American general, he did as much as anyone short of Washington for the American cause. But it was as a traitor that he woke up the American people to the fact that this war was theirs to lose. And within a year, we would see the great victory at Yorktown. And, you know, such is the irony of history. And it's also, you know, it's also a statement of character. I think ultimately you can see what would ultimately happen with Arnold from the very beginning, but you could never anticipate the avenues that he would take.
And he, to some extent, we don't want to overstate his influence, but to some extent woke up the American people to recognizing that the fighting, the Civil War aspects of this had to come to an end, that this country was far too fragile in those early days and needed to be brought together if they were going to survive as a country.
Yeah, and you know, and remember, our sense of ourselves as a country, Washington is the great hero. In any Genesis story, you also need a villain. And Arnold gave us that villain. You know, up until that point, the American people had simply decided to King George, we're out of here. You know, we were rebels. When Arnold stepped center stage, we now had the villain. We could turn the narrative away from the fact that we walked away from the pact we had with the king and talk about how the American people were betrayed by this one individual. We now had the Satan in the garden of our creation.
He went on and lived the rest of his life in England with his wife Peggy, yes?
Yeah, he'd have some time in Nova Scotia trying to, as a merchant, but it would not be a happy post-revolutionary life. You know, he was a traitor in the eyes of Americans, and he was also a traitor in the eyes of the British. And he would die in a bad economic situation. His wife, Peggy, would be able to bring the family back. And several of his sons would serve with distinction in the British military. And so a sad and tragic figure.
Yeah, I think you just said that's the word. This is your drama, your book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution, tells us a story almost like a Greek tragedy, and Benedict Arnold is that figure. Thank you so much, Nathaniel Philbrick, for talking to us today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
We've posted information about Nathaniel Philbrick's book, Valiant Ambition, on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS. And you can find it on our Facebook page, too. Before we leave you today, I want to tell you about a special event we have coming up in a couple of weeks. On Tuesday evening, May 23rd, we're going to go back to the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library to record another show in front of a live audience. Our guest will be Mark Pendergast. He's written a book called City on the Verge about the city of Atlanta. Pendergast writes that Atlanta is on the verge of tremendous rebirth or inexorable decline. He thinks the city is a kind of a petri dish for cities struggling to reinvent themselves. We'd love to have you join us for the evening. Admission is free and you don't need to make a reservation. Just be there well before we start at 7 p.m. That's Tuesday, May 23rd, 7 p.m. at the Carter Library. That's it for this week's show. Our senior producer is the blissfully buoyant Jenny Ament. Our producer is the blamelessly blithe Lisa Clark. And our engineer is the boyishly brash Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. Hope to see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.